from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, both sides in Ukraine accuse the other in civilian deaths. An attempt to aid those fleeing the fighting in Iraq.
They don't have food, water, non-food items like blankets, anything to sit on the floor, clothes. These are the immediate needs.
Controversy over the method of collecting casualty figures in Gaza. And the FAA issues a notice restricting U.S. carriers from flying over Syria. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Pro-Moscow separatists and Ukrainian government officials are swapping accusations over who was behind a rocket strike on a convoy of civilians as it left the eastern city of Luhansk. Jamie Detmer has details from Kiev.
Another day in the struggle in Ukraine's easternmost regions between pro-Moscow separatists and Ukrainian government forces, and even more accusations are being traded over another incident involving civilian deaths. The circumstances remain murky, and the allegations being made by the combatants can't be independently verified.
Доброго дня, шановні колеги. Сьогодні о 9:40 ранку терористи здійснили кривавий злочин.
Ukraine security spokesman Colonel Andrei Lysenko announced late Monday at a news conference in Kiev that separatists had fired Grad rockets and mortars at a convoy of civilians fleeing the besieged city of Luhansk, accusing them of using weapons supplied by Russia. He says women and children are among the dead, but is unable to say how many have died in the attack. Other Ukraine officials say some of the dead were burned to death in their vehicles. The separatists deny the allegation, although insurgent leaders don't deny some kind of rocket attack took place Monday that led to civilian deaths. But they accuse Ukrainian government forces of being behind the deadly strike. They say Ukrainian forces are bombing roads. The US State Department condemned the shelling and rocketing of the convoy, but said it couldn't confirm who was responsible. Since April, when a Ukrainian army supported by volunteer battalions launched a counterinsurgency operation to try and wrest cities and towns seized by separatists in Donetsk and Luhansk regions, the death toll has crept up. Last week, the United Nations nearly doubled its estimate of the number of people killed in eastern Ukraine to 2,086 as of August the 10th. Half are likely civilians, officials told VOA. They include 298 who died in the downing of a Malaysian commercial jet last month, brought down by a missile Western governments say was fired by rebels and supplied by Russia. The UN blames most civilian casualties on the separatists. Some civilians in Donetsk and Luhansk, it isn't clear how many, have died when Grad rockets struck their homes. The rumble of rocket and mortar exchanges are heard every day in both cities, with episodic bombardments most often at night or around dawn. Residents are fearful, with most blaming government forces for the strikes. Artom, a retired mine worker, says his small neighborhood in an inner city district of Donetsk was hit last week by a Grad rocket strike at about midnight. Several houses were damaged, and he insists the attack was methodical, with the Grads striking in a chess-like way. Ukrainian officials say they are only fighting a ground war and are not firing artillery towards residential areas. They claim rebels are responsible themselves, doing so for propaganda purposes in order to put the blame on Kiev. Again, the accuracy of the claims of either side are difficult to verify. But VOA has heard Grads being launched from behind government lines and has been told by Ukrainian soldiers that insurgent mortar and rocket fire is answered by their own. Equally, though, VOA has travelled down roads in and out of Donetsk that have come under mortar fire from rebel positions. Combatants from both sides are operating in residential areas, mixing in with civilians, and the ordnance being used is old and far from accurate. Jamie Detmer, VOA News, Kiev.
The fighting continues in Iraq between the Iraqi military and fighters from the Islamic State group known by some as ISIL. Monday, after the U.S. military helped Iraqi and Kurd forces recapture a strategic dam in the north from the Sunni extremists, President Obama held a news conference. He said he sees important progress across the spectrum of U.S. efforts in Iraq.
Over the last 11 days, American airstrikes have stopped the ISIL advance around the city of Erbil and pushed back the terrorists. Meanwhile, we have urgently provided additional arms and assistance to Iraqi forces, including Kurdish and Iraqi security forces who are fighting on the front lines. Today, with our support, Iraqi and Kurdish forces took a major step forward by recapturing the largest dam in Iraq near the city of Mosul. The Mosul dam fell under terrorist control earlier this month and is directly tied to our objective of protecting Americans in Iraq. If that dam was breached, it could have proven catastrophic, with floods that would have threatened the lives of thousands of civilians and endanger our embassy compound in Baghdad. Iraqi and Kurdish forces took the lead on the ground and performed with courage and determination. So this operation demonstrates that Iraqi and Kurdish forces are capable of working together and taking the fight to ISIL. If they continue to do so, they will have the strong support of the United States of America.
President Obama also said the U.S. will continue working to build an international coalition to address the humanitarian needs of the Iraqis. And he said the U.S. will continue to pursue a long-term strategy to turn the tide against the Islamic State militants by supporting Iraq's new government and working with key partners in the region and beyond.
Over the last week, we saw historic progress as Iraqis named a new prime minister designate, Haider al-Abadi, and Iraq's outgoing Prime Minister Maliki agreed to step down. This peaceful transition of power will mark a major milestone in Iraq's political development, but as I think we're all aware, the work is not yet done. Over the next few weeks, Dr. Abadi needs to complete the work of forming a new, broad-based, inclusive Iraqi government, one that develops a national program to address the interests of all Iraqis. Without that progress, extremists like ISIL can continue to prey upon Iraq's divisions. With that new government in place, Iraqis will be able to unite the country against the threat from ISIL, and they will be able to look forward to increased support, not just from the United States, but from other countries in the region and around the world. Let's remember, ISIL poses a threat to all Iraqis and to the entire region. They claim to represent Sunni grievances, but they slaughter Sunni men, women, and children. They claim to oppose foreign forces, but they actively recruit foreign fighters to advance their hateful ideology. So the Iraqi people need to reject them and unite to begin to push them out of the lands that they've occupied, as we're seeing at Mosul Dam. And this is going to take time. There are going to be many challenges ahead. But meanwhile, there should be no doubt that the United States military will continue to carry out the limited missions that I've authorized, protecting our personnel and facilities in Iraq, in both Erbil and Baghdad, and providing humanitarian support as we did on Mount Sinjar.
The United States first launched airstrikes in northern Iraq earlier this month against the insurgents, in part to prevent the killing of thousands of stranded Yazidis who had sought refuge in the Sinjar Mountains. In Geneva, the United Nations Refugee Agency said it is preparing a massive operation to provide aid to 500,000 people displaced in northern Iraq. The agency said tents and other supplies will be airlifted to Erbil, the capital of the Kurdish Autonomous Region, starting Wednesday. The UN estimates that 1.2 million Iraqis have been displaced by fighting this year since the Islamic State group took over large parts of northwestern Iraq. International Relief and Development is among the organizations trying to help in Iraq. Akbal Al-Jabouri works with IRD's Iraq program.
We work with host communities, the grassroots communities, to do a bit of conflict mitigation, capacity building training, and we have some works with the internally displaced people that are right now are in thousands. In the three areas in the northern parts of Iraq.
What are you trying to accomplish there?
We have worked in Iraq for a long time, since 2003. And our main objective is, of course, to assist the people in need, but as well as to improve the capacity, whether it's with the local councils, to deal with the crisis that is happening right now. And this is like a good example. A lot of people fled from ISIS attacks from their cities, and they went to a safer place. And the local councils, the local authorities, had no clue what to do in such a crisis. Therefore, they need a lot of assistance. We have been there trying to assist them to improve that capacity.
What is the greatest need for these people?
Well, I would say the most important needs or the dire needs are food and water. Those people left their homes, their clothes, everything, and they just fled. And they don't have anything. Some of them were stuck in Sinjar Mountain. Some of them were stuck between the fights. And some of them are occupying public buildings, schools, mosques, or even in the streets. So they don't have food, water, non-food items like blankets, anything to sit on the floor, clothes. These are the immediate needs. And, of course, once this is provided, and it is a huge need, because they have it is there like a large number of IDPs, then we can talk about the other needs.
Do you see your work making a difference?
Yes, I do. Through the years, I've seen a lot of people who are really in need of assistance. We've managed to reach those people. Of course, as an organization, we can do so much, but it is so thrilling for me to see that we made a difference to a person's life, especially now. We have distributed water, food to a lot of people who couldn't find food to eat. I mean, in this day and age, how could you imagine finding a person not, you know, hungry? To me, it is impossible to even conceive. So yes, we made a difference to a lot of people's lives, and I hope we continue to do so. It's not only, I mean, As an international organization, IRD has always tried to assist the people in need. And in Iraq, we've done that.
And it's bad enough for the adults, but the children, it must be impossible for them.
That's the hardest story. I mean, to see really the children, there is a large number of the population who fled the fights consists of children. And, you know, it is... In a conflict, it is always the weak, let's say, or the helpless or the vulnerable, as we call them, are the people who are hit the most, and children and women are of those. So we are trying to assist, but again, it has to be like an international community movement towards assisting those people. We are trying to assist the children as well, and the women.
What else would you need? Is there anything that people can do to help?
Well, definitely funding is the most important thing right now. I would call definitely for anyone's assistance to give any funding. That will help save people's lives. We are at this stage where there are not a lot of funds available for the organizations to work, and this impacts our work in saving people's lives. Therefore, if anyone has the capacity, to donate anything, that will be something great, because that will eliminate some of the needs out there to buy food and water and assist those people to, survive this. This will be awesome.
Iqbal Al-Jabouri, Senior Program Officer with International Relief and Development. New airstrikes are reported between Israel and the Hamas Palestinians in Gaza. Truce negotiations had been going on, but the gap between the two sides remains wide. Israel demands the disarming of Hamas and an end to its cross-border rocket attacks. The Palestinians are calling for an end of Israel's 8-year blockade of the impoverished Gaza Strip. 5 weeks of fighting have left more than 2,000 people dead, most of them Palestinians. It also has left Gaza neighborhoods in rubble from Israeli airstrikes. 67 Israelis also have been killed. All but 3 were soldiers. Israel's UN ambassador, Ron Prosser, Monday, took issue with the way the United Nations has gathered casualty figures from the Gaza conflict.
Have you wondered where the UN gets its casualty figures from? I'll tell you where. From Hamas. Let me be perfectly clear. Israel regards every civilian casualty as a tragedy. But let's be honest about what is going on. Hamas purposely put its people in harm's way as part of a propaganda war.
Stephanie Dujarric, the spokesperson for Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, disputed Prosser's allegation.
So UN does not just take, does not get its casualty figures from Hamas. The Office for the High Commissioner of Human Rights, its protection cluster is tasked with trying to put together preliminary figures, which it does from various sources, including NGOs on the ground, health ministries, and puts together what it feels comfortable putting out.
Secretary General Ban has taken a tough stance on Israel, especially on the deadly attacks on UN schools that have been sheltering civilians. But he has also repeatedly demanded that Gaza stop firing rockets at Israel and blamed Hamas for violating a ceasefire. The U.S. Federal Aviation Administration Monday issued a notice to airmen restricting U.S. carriers from flying over Syria, siding with the agency calls the ongoing armed conflict and volatile security environment that poses a serious potential threat to civil aviation. It notes that armed extremist groups in Syria are known to be equipped with a variety of anti-aircraft weapons, which have the capability to threaten civilian aircraft. Earlier this month, the FAA restricted U.S. carriers from flying over Iraq. Scott Hamilton of the Washington State-based aviation consultancy Leham Company told VOA's Victor Beatty he is surprised the FAA didn't act sooner, given the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, July 17th, over eastern Ukraine by a surface-to-air missile.
The fact that you had an airplane that was flying at 33,000 feet and it got shot down, suddenly they wake up and say there's a problem when you fly over a war zone, it's just mind-boggling.
I guess what's happening on the ground has forced the FAA to become, what would you say, more sensitive to what's going on the ground around the world?
I think that's a fair conclusion, and the FAA, unfortunately, has been known for decades as a tombstone agency. They don't take action until somebody dies, and as tragic as MH17 was concerned, that's the Malaysian flight that went down over the Ukraine after being shot down. But where in the world has the FAA been? This is just another example of tombstone mentality. And I think, as much as I hate to say it, because Congress always overreacts to stuff anyway, that somebody ought to be asking some tough questions of the FAA.
What impact will this have on transcontinental flights?
What the effect is it will mean longer routings, more cost in terms of fuel, wear and tear on the airplanes. But flying around hostile areas is not at all uncommon. You know, U.S. Airlines have been flying around the Korean Peninsula since the Korean War. To this day, you can't overfly North Korea. So anything going from Tokyo to China, for example, has to fly around the Korean Peninsula or certainly around the North Korean airspace. So this is not new.
Todd Curtis, founder of the Seattle-based website airsafe.com, says many carriers long ago came to the conclusion Syrian airspace was too dangerous.
Recently, I looked at one of the many commercial applications that are out there, a website that tracks commercial activity all over the world. And it's interesting that on this morning, August 19th, there was actually no commercial airliners of any kind flying over Syrian airspace. And surprisingly, there were quite a few over northern Iraq, but none over Syria. So this has been something that the FAA didn't have to come out with a change of ruling. I believe other countries, and more specifically other airlines, have seen fit to avoid that area while that situation sorts itself out.
There's an organization in Switzerland called the Small Arms Survey. They came out with a report recently indicating armed groups in Syria have an estimated several hundred portable anti-aircraft missiles that can easily be diverted to extremists and used to destroy low-flying commercial planes. Is it becoming increasingly dangerous to fly the world's skies today?
Well, it's increasingly dangerous for that reason that was mentioned, not just in Syria or in that region, but small shoulder-fired missiles are common throughout the world in conflict zones. Now, the bad thing about those missiles is that they can cause serious damage to large commercial airliners and may even shoot them down. One limitation that these systems have is that they typically can only be effective up to about 10 to 15,000 feet. When aircraft are flying at cruising altitudes, typically in the 30,000 to 40,000 foot range, those kinds of missiles won't be a hazard. But as MH17 has showed, if you have a new system introduced into an area, a system that has the capability to reach into the stratosphere, and if airlines are not aware of it, they could unwittingly fly into areas where they could be reached by these missiles. And it's unclear whether that sort of situation is happening right now in Syria.
Curtis says today's environment is making it more challenging for governments and carriers to determine which airspace needs to be avoided. He says there are only a handful of countries, especially the United States, with the capability of cataloging the threats that exist. He says the challenge is devising a way to quickly transfer that information to global civil aviation organizations without compromising the sources or methods that make civilian aviation safe.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Three relatives of Pope Francis have been killed in a car crash in Argentina. The Pope's nephew, Emmanuel Horacio Bergoglio, was driving in the central province of Cordoba when his small car struck a truck today, lodging beneath the rear of the vehicle. His sons, ages 8 months and 2 years, and their mother, the driver's wife, died in the crash. The 38-year-old Bergoglio remains hospitalized. He is the son of the Pope's late brother. Vatican spokesman, the Reverend Federico Lombardi, said the Pope knew of the accident and had asked all those who share in his pain to join him in prayer. The World Health Organization warns of a growing trend of targeting health workers in hospitals during conflicts and humanitarian crises. The UN agency issued the warning to mark World Humanitarian Day today. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The World Health Organization says that major emergencies around the world are increasing in scale, complexity, and frequency. It says that's denying many people their fundamental right to health. Dr. Richard Brennan is director of the WHO's Department of Emergency Risk Management and Humanitarian Response.
Over the last 18 months is probably the busiest period in the history of humanitarian work, and that's due to a number of high-profile and very impactful emergencies in places such as Syria, South Sudan, Central African Republic, Iraq, and the Ebola epidemic right now in West Africa, not to mention all the other crises that aren't quite as prominent, such as Somalia and Yemen and Eastern Congo.
The recent conflict in Gaza is another example. Health workers, clinics, patients, and ambulances have been deliberately targeted in those conflicts. Brennan says that denies many people medical care when they need it most. In Pakistan and Nigeria, those administering polio vaccines have been attacked. Most of them are women. Dr. Brennan says it's a violation of international law.
It's the abandonment of this widely held principle that's been around for hundreds, if not thousands, of years of the sanctity of healthcare.
He says the main victims of conflicts in the 21st century are civilians.
We're seeing this terribly right now in northern Iraq, of course, but we've seen it in South Sudan, in Central African Republic. In Central African Republic, you've seen whole religious and ethnic groups forced from their communities, religious and ethnic cleansing. And underlying all of this are political issues. And unfortunately, the political leaders, the community leaders, aren't stepping forward to address the underlying causes. And it's left to the humanitarians to come in and apply Band-Aid measures, essentially.
He says millions of people are suffering as a result. The WHO official has a message for the leaders of the warring parties.
For the leaders of those groups, I'd ask them to move beyond their own greed, their own lust for power, their own pride, and sit down with their counterparts and come up with a compromise so that their people can live in peace.
The World Health Organization says it's working with its partners to better document, prevent, and respond to attacks on health workers. It calls caring for the sick and vulnerable in the world's most difficult circumstances one of the most pressing responsibilities of the international community. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
New parents in the United States will have to tighten their budgets after new data shows the cost of raising a child is inching toward $250,000. Research by the U.S. Department of Agriculture shows middle-income parents will spend just over $245,000 on a baby born in 2013 until the child turns 18, the age of legal adulthood in the U.S. The largest expense for new parents is housing, which accounts for almost one-third of the projected cost. Child care, education, and food also top the list. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. Don't forget to visit our website, voanews.com. Reporting from Washington, I'm Susan Yawkey.